don't have with me in the studio, another one of those disappearing tapes, but I hope to play it at some point, as well as to make a formal complaint about it. And that'll have to be for another show. What we have instead is an earlier conversation I had this morning with Jerry Henry. Jerry, as you may remember, is a street minister at the Aptos Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center, who has been complaining of significant harassment by the police. Let's see what he has to say. The line this Sunday morning with Jerry Henry, who is a street minister, and how would you describe your role in the community, Jerry?
Well, I'm a disabled person that's been involved in ministry, just the physical needs of ministry. So I'm not a preacher.
And you've been doing a lot of kind of advising young people of their basic civil rights. In using public spaces in Aptos Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center?
Well, I haven't started out advising them. It's just that I've stood there with them and been willing to share with them my sight as far as what I feel I see. And
what kind of problems have they been encountering out there?
Well, they've turned us into sign land, and I call it the Disneyland syndrome. Just want to chase everybody off that they don't think's acceptable. Unfortunately, a lot of our children seem like they think they're not acceptable or something. And
how do they
feel about poorer people and stuff? The poorer people in our society and stuff, they just don't seem to.
And how has this lack of acceptability made dramatic and visible for these young people out in the Aptos Shopping Center?
Well, through signs, and then the First Alarm Security Company and the Sheriff's Department, just a never-ending assault on them.
What kind of signs and what kind of contacts with First Alarm and the deputies?
Well, I think that sign that probably is the most flagrant about it is no setting on rails. That they want to charge you with obstruction of business for setting on a rail.
You mean stuff that's outside businesses, sort of in the public areas that you on the sidewalks?
Oh yeah, outside businesses and the same rails that our sheriffs set on.
I see. So what's sauce for the sheriffs is not sauce for the young people, so to speak. Huh?
And it's so selective. I mean, they literally pick out and target people. Some of the merchants out there have.
How long have you been monitoring this situation?
Well, it's monitoring it make it sound like it was something I sought. They first shoved me, they first came up and started shoving me in January 5th, 1996.
And by who is they? What, First Alarm? Or
it was First Alarm.
That's the so-called security guards who hired by the merchants to kind of...
It just really... I couldn't believe it. I made a police report then, and the police, seemed to be flatly on the merchant side. It's totally escalated since our new sheriff's departments came in.
There was a new sheriff's substation put in there, and I guess there was a controversy that ensued when Sergeant Deverell tried to paint himself a special red parking place, and this was contested by local activist Richard Quigley, who parked his own car there, and then I guess Quigley became, by his account, the subject of a vendetta by Deverell and his friends in the sheriff's department. And you yourself, however, have been in court a number of times. How many times have the sheriffs taken you to court for essentially, I guess the way you would describe it is simply being present with the young people at the Aptos Shopping Center?
It's just being present in the village. I'm standing there by myself.
And so how many times have you been to court?
Oh, I would put it up in about the number 20 times. We're going on 11 months right now, and the next court date has been postponed till June 1st. I've been assigned my fourth DA.
Now, what kind of charges have you been facing typically in court?
They're all 602.1.
That's interfering, trespass with intent to interfere with a business or something?
Yeah, willfully interfere with a business.
And you're listening to Jerry Henry, street minister and activist in Aptos Shopping Center, who was on the phone with us this morning. We're going to continue that interview. These are the closing moments of Bathrob Spear's broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor.
You've met me. It's like Cyril Peterson says, there's good deputies. Some days I have good days, some days I have bad days. Some days it's everything I can do to get out of bed and keep going.
So you regard the Apto Shopping Center as kind of one of your one of the place that you naturally go to, and just sort of part of your sort of what your normal transit is, right?
Well, it's one of the people that I know. That's where our village meets. That's our town square.
Well, would you say that above and beyond your own personal needs and right to exist and live and be a part of the community and be in public spaces or have harassment, is there an issue regarding young people there? Are they getting some kind of, improper treatment or discriminatory treatment that you think should be stopped or addressed?
Well, the young people, there was an incident this last week when there's a young man there that I happen to know his family and they know him quite well, and he's one of the most brilliant children in our community. I've just been talking to a science teacher 2 days before. His science teacher feels he's probably the most brilliant child he's ever had. And he comes from a poor family, but a real good family. And they pull up and drag him, his 7-year-old little brother and 9-year-old little sister, into the sheriff's department and search him and threaten.
For what reason?
Oh, one of the things I heard while I went and sat in the police station trying to offer what I could was that they were hanging out with the nut.
And you, of course, are the nut?
It seems to be that this is Officer Faber.
And we're just about at the end of our time. That was an interview with Jerry Herman, accusing Officer Thurber and others at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center of harassment of youth, and specifically targeting young people who were sitting with him, dragging them into police department headquarters there, the sheriff's substation, saying, why are you hanging out with the nuts, searching them, and so forth. A lot of interesting stuff came over the internet this week. I think we only have time for one very brief item, maybe not that brief, but I'll keep going until I get cut off. This was an April 15th item, Faith Waning for Savior of Homeless, Health Finances Failing. John Cook finds himself on the other end of charity in the Las Vegas Sun. It's not a confession one would expect from a man of the cloth, unless the guy is called John 3:16 Cook. And that's, I guess, Book 3, Verse 16. And his clerical collar happens to be in his breast pocket, peeking out the top like a sort of holy tongue depressor. Then somehow the candor seems fitting. I've been kind of losing faith. The old man has turned his back on me, said Cook, tugging on a cigarette. I'm crippled. My heart is bad. I can hardly work. I can hardly walk. 30 years I've been helping people, and this is where I'm at. God kind of sucks right now. Cook tries to laugh, then looks away. Wisps of red slowly seep into the whites of his eyes. His voice drops to a rasp. I just want to go out and feed people. That simple mission has defined the latter half of Cook's life. A fiery, often controversial advocate for the homeless whose work has taken him from Florida to Nevada, he has been up and down, loved and loathed, accused and exonerated. Through all of it, run-ins with city officials, disputes over his methods, questions about his past, Cook has always found the wherewithal to comfort the less fortunate. Along the way, he got called every name not in the good book, but nobody could label him helpless. Until now. At age 65, in constant physical agony and nearly broke, John 3:16 Cook needs a miracle to stay off the streets himself. I can't believe this happened to me. I'm at wit's end, he said, rocking slightly in a worn wicker chair. I got people who depend on me. Those depending on him are the shadow residents of Las Vegas, the people who can squeeze all their belongings into a grocery cart, who make their home under highway overpasses or next to train tracks, whose plight is at once painfully obvious and virtually invisible. Cook has sought to bring them out of the darkness since he arrived in Las Vegas 12 years ago, driving the converted postal truck he still owns. It didn't take long for residents and city officials alike to realize this was not your typical man in black. In 1986, Cook opened Pride Village, a homeless shelter on Bonanza Road that bore his trademark slogan, Soup, Soap, and Hope. The mission provided warm meals, a place to sleep, and job referrals. There also was medical help of a kind, anyway. Cook pulled teeth, stitched wounds, and delivered babies. Despite his considerable sweat and resolve, the city closed the financially hobbled shelter 2 years later over building code violations that he insisted were trumped up. Undaunted, Cook took to the streets in his truck, emblazoned with his name, slogan, and the words, Feeding the Poor. Every day he offered hundreds of sandwiches, gallons of Kool-Aid, blankets, razors, cigarettes, and even the occasional shot of whiskey to those in need. He became a Pied Piper of the homeless, drawing them from unseen enclaves when his mobile mission pulled to the curb. With Cook's lone wolf approach to faith, his words invariably received as much attention as his actions. He condemned churches for failing to aid the homeless and blasted charities for selling a lion's share of their donations overseas. His favorite target became the Salvation Army, which he rechristened the Starvation Army. His maverick style spurred heavy criticism from city officials and civic leaders. Former Mayor Ron Lurie variously referred to Cook as a fraud and kook. The Sun ran a poll in 1988 that showed 4 out of every 5 readers wanted Cook to leave town. Predictably, he ignored the results, instead entering an array of political races in the early 90s. Assemblyman, mayor, city council, even sheriff, that he didn't even come close to winning. I ran for everything, Cook conceded, but I've never run from anything. His critics might say he's never stopped running from himself. Known as Sonny Austin during his career as a Hollywood stuntman, Cook took the fall for Clark Gable in The Misfits. He became a born-again Christian in 1969. That year, the Korean War veteran walked in a Baptist church in the nowhere town of Pitcher, Oklahoma, and heard the biblical verse that changed his life and his name. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Not long after, Cook became an ordained minister and hopped on the Bible Belt evangelical circuit. 2 years later, he suffered a depressing epiphany. He was mired in show business all over again. Instead of a stage, I had a podium, said Cook, lapsing into his rhythmic preacher's cadence. Instead of drawing a paycheck, they took up an offering. Instead of an audience, I had a congregation. I sold autographed pictures, but it was all phony. In search of an authentic calling, Cook started working with the homeless. The story would play out in cities like St. Petersburg, Florida, Lafayette, Louisiana, and a half dozen others, much as it did years later in Las Vegas. After helping get people off the streets, Cook's shelters would come under fire for code violations and money woes. Local newspapers and TV stations would dig up troubling reports on his marriages and children. He's had 16 of the former, 8 of the latter. The unproven allegations that he stole $39,000 from his mentally incompetent son would resurface, and inevitably, if not always quietly, Cook would depart for another town. Compared to that turbulent history, the last 5 years have been a time of peace for Cook and his wife. Magical Marissa, a witch, metaphysician, and astrologer, his wife. The couple, together since 1988, has continued to tool around Las Vegas in the rickety postal truck, handing out ham sandwiches and a morsel of hope. But a spate of misfortune has put future deliveries in limbo. In December, the rent doubled on the home the Cooks lived in for almost a decade. Forced to find an apartment, the couple couldn't afford more than a cramped 2-bedroom and had to fork over a sizable deposit that drained their savings. As of today, the nation's deadline for filing taxes, that was on the 15th, the Cooks had all of $17 in their bank account. Worse, the move has hurt donations to their cause. Where once people swung by the Cook's house to drop off bread, clothes, and other supplies, few people know their new address. 2 forlorn boxes of hamburger buns sit outside their apartment, the only contributions they've seen of late. As though fate were piling on, the truck's transmission blew out a few weeks ago. So forgive the Cooks if they're a little quieter than usual in praising the Lord these days. It's the worst it's ever been in my life, John said. When you can't go out on Easter, it's bad. Even if supplies were pouring in, Cook's health would make delivering them difficult. Rheumatoid arthritis and a botched surgery on his left ankle have left his legs gnarled and in braces. Emphysema clogs his lungs, triggering violent hacking spells. Standing up to show a visitor the holes in his tattered navy blue dress shirt, Cook's withered legs nearly give way. Sitting back down, he falls into a coughing fit, his face turning crimson. "There's a lot of pain," Cook wheezed, placing a trembling hand on Marissa's knee. "I'm lucky I got the prettiest woman you'll ever see to help me." The ailments also prevent Cook from earning the unconventional living he long scratched out. Used to be, he haunted swap meets, flea markets, and yard sales, buying assorted items for a dime or a quarter. After selling them elsewhere for twice what he paid, Cook spent the money on supplies for his street flocks. Today, the couple has to squeak by on the $800 Cook draws in Social Security and military benefits, and the $200 Marissa earns writing an astrology column for a local entertainment magazine. After rent and other bills, they have less than $200 left over to put food on their own table, much less anyone else's. In other words, after decades of giving, Cook could stand to be on the receiving end for a while. "We need help, boy. We really need it this time," he said. But as quickly as he pleads for divine intervention, Cook catches himself. Remembering the people who are waiting for him, he starts rattling off all the essentials they need, from shoes to hygiene products. As the list grows, it becomes evident that providing a bit of relief for the homeless is the only way John 3:16 Cook will ever get any himself. "The only time I'm not in pain is when I'm out there feeding people," Cook said. There's got to be a miracle. John 3:16 Cook and Magical Marissa live at 5325 Redberry Street, Apartment A, Las Vegas, Nevada, 89108. Phone number 396-5525. This is a story off the internet, originally from the Las Vegas Sun by Martin Cuz. Health finances failing, John 3:16 Cook finds himself on the other end of charity. So, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and I'm waiting for the next talk show host to come in, the ever restless Reckless, who should come tripping in very soon. While I'm waiting, I'm going to read you from Grassroots Report, which is a small publication put out by Pebbles Trippett. And for those of you who are longtime marijuana activists concerned about the rights of people to use medical marijuana or recreational marijuana without being arrested, having their houses broken into, their families shot at, their savings seized. This is a very interesting publication. I've just become aware of it. I picked up a couple copies up on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley when I was up there last week. Pebbles is a woman who's been fighting for the right to use medical marijuana for several decades, and she has been very outspoken and out front about it, and I think she served several years in jail, certainly at least 6 months, over on the issue, and she continues to carry marijuana with her and smoke it medicinally. I'm going to read her grassroots report, I guess from last year, because I think it's worth considering. California Appeals Court broadens Proposition 215. Ruling holds medical marijuana legalization retroactive, also finds implied defense to transporting, etc., but quantity limit a proof burden issue fogged. So this is a positive development that happened actually about 6 months ago in the field of marijuana law. Activist dumps lawyer, wins precedent, tells how, by Pebbles Trippett. A California appeals court has unanimously ruled that Proposition 215, the medical marijuana ballot initiative, retroactively benefits eligible defendants with cases still pending, including on appeal, when the voters enacted it in 1996. The court has also ruled that although 215 only explicitly created a defense to Health and Safety Code sections 11357, possession, and 11358, cultivation, it has also created an implied defense to Health and Safety Code section 11360, transporting, furnishing, selling, etc. So not only can you cultivate and possess, but there's an implied defense to charges of transporting, furnishing, and selling. The 8/15/97 ruling, August 15/97 ruling in People versus Trippett, also indicates that the 215-based medical need defense will be much more lenient than a common law-based medical necessity defense. But the ruling apparently seeks to narrow 215 regarding quantity limits, decreeing that patients can only possess or transport enough for undefined current medical needs. And a September 5th, 97 modification suggests that patients presenting defenses based on 215, unlike any comparable defenses, can be required to bear the burden of proof of their innocence. The reason I know all this stuff is that I'm the defendant who dumped her lawyer and filed the brief that won the best drug law ruling in California courts in decades. Actually, it was pretty much the state's only good drug-related decision since the 1970s. So if you want the inside dope, read on. The story starts with my 1995 conviction for possessing and transporting 2 pounds of leaf after a Contra Costa judge barred my jury from hearing my necessity defense of my or my doctor's testimony that he recommends pot for my migraine condition. I had finished my 6-month jail term, but my appeal was still pending in November 1996 when the voters passed Proposition 215. In the first reported post-election case, the Sonoma public defenders pressured a defendant into a plea bargain after advising him 215 wasn't retroactive. But I felt if medical marijuana users don't deserve jail, it makes no sense to continue jailing us just because we were busted before the election. So I asked my pro bono appeal lawyer, Randall Stoner, to try to get 215 applied to my case. Stoner refused, saying he wasn't willing to do that much additional unpaid work, and when the appellate justices asked him about it at the April 97 hearing, he argued that 215 did not affect my case. The court wasn't willing to drop it, so they invited supplemental briefing. They also gave Stoner the ultimate insult by publicly asking him if he was a lawyer and implying his position was so incompetent that I would be given a right to a new appeal with another lawyer if he didn't improve it. I then fired Stoner and filed an a pro per brief, that's doing it herself, arguing that 215's medical use defense should be available to anyone still being prosecuted, including on appeal, for acts legalized by 215. 215, again, is the proposition that makes medical marijuana legal. The court agreed and reversed my convictions for retrial under post-215 law. Justice Paul Hairley's opinion cites People v. Rossi for the common law rule that if there's no specific contrary provision, a new defense is presumed available to any case still pending when the law changes. Thus, any otherwise eligible defendant can invoke Proposition 215, even for old busts, if the case was still pending in any lower or higher court on or after Election Day, November 5, 1996. I also argued that 215, which does not directly change the laws on anything but possessing and cultivating by patients and caregivers, should be broadened to include all acts reasonably necessary to fulfill its stated goal, which is to ensure that seriously ill Californians have the right to obtain and use marijuana for medical purposes. In my case, this meant transportation, but the same logic can also be applied to furnishing or sale, affecting many defendants, including Dennis Perrone and others, still facing charges from the pre-election 1996 bust of the San Francisco Cannabis Buyers Club. At first, the court condemned any reading of implied defenses into 215, saying it would have been a simple matter for the drafters to have included a reference to section. And we're going to stop here because the station has been invaded by alien broadcasters. And I'm fighting them off, but I'm going to have to go now before I get thoroughly squashed. I want you to stay tuned for Reckless, who is beyond description, but will probably describe herself shortly. And come back to Bathrob Spears Broadsides when we return on Thursday. And that's going to be Thursday at 6 o'clock for all you fans, 6 to 8 in the evening. If you have anything you want to contribute to Bathrob Spears Broadsides in the interim, give a call to 423-HUFF. Stay with us, hang in there, and listen up.
What is it for? For millions to be living.